Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, here with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, you've been thinking a lot lately about what's driving the divisions in American society, divisions that, you know, we've only seen more acutely in the wake of the midterm elections. And most recently, you thought about this in a piece for National Review, which was entitled "The Issues That Tore Us Apart." And you actually begin that piece with some historical perspective, wherein you note that the Civil War, of course, arose out of the divisions around slavery, but that it's not appreciated how many other issues magnified the differences at that time. So explain what some of those factors were.
Well, they had had a difference over slavery since the founding in 1776 and then constitutional's founding in 1787. But what happened was that during the Industrial Revolution that had started in the mid-19th century, the demand for fabric, especially cotton from the New World, was such that it was creating wealth that we had never seen in the history of civilization in the South. And that gave the Southern plantationist class a sense that they were invaluable, irreplaceable, and with them the labor necessary to pick the cotton. And there was also the sense that tariffs that were protecting Northern industrial business vis-a-vis industrial England and Northern Europe were hurting the exporting South. And then there was a feeling that the money that was coming into Washington was being redistributed to where the 30 million people were up north and not the 11 million down south in terms of, you know, the Erie Canal or new railways or bridges and internal improvements. And so out of that, the South had this aggrieved sense of wrong, and that was a force multiplier of slavery. And the two regions didn't really interact in the way they had before. And there was a particular dialect, a particular manner, a particular comportment that was almost so different from the North that they almost were two different countries.
And as you note in the piece, this is something of an analogy to today insofar as there are all of these different factors at work that are sort of underpinning these divisions. And I'll turn to the first one that you present in the piece, which is globalization. And this is interesting because in elite circles anyway, this was up until 5 minutes ago a matter of something like consensus. You had fairly broad bipartisan support for free trade, and you had people like Tom Friedman, who's sort of a weather vane for conventional wisdom, writing these globalization homilies like the world is flat. How do we go from that world to one in which this is now, as you see it, sort of a core schism in American society?
Well, I think people started to see that culture on the two coasts and maybe circled in some around the Great Lakes and places like Minnesota, Northern Michigan, was dependent on globalized trade, and people had been offshoring and outsourcing jobs that were manufacturing or industrial, and there became the idea that if your mustard labor could be Xeroxed elsewhere, it was. But that people on the coast had particular financial expertise or high-tech expertise or retailing expertise, and therefore they thrived in a new market of 7 billion people. And out of that reality, which is true, we went to the next step the last few years where we said the winners are winners because they're better people. They went to college, or they're less racist, or they're more cosmopolitan, or they understand the world. And then we kind of flip cause and effect, and we said, well, the losers in Youngstown or Lansing or Bakersfield, their jobs disappeared because they took opiates or they didn't get educated, where in fact the jobs disappeared first and the despair came. And out of that, we got this dichotomy between what Hillary and Bill Clinton or John McCain, they've called them the deplorables, the irredeemables, the clingers, the East Germans, the wacko birds, all those people. And there's two different distinctions. If I go to rural America, I don't see a lot of guys with ankle boots shoes and kind of high water pants and suits and single couples with no children, and everybody's in an apartment. There's still an attempt in the Midwest or rural California to get married in your early 20s, to have kids, to try to buy a house, and then to plug into the American dream. Whereas this other culture is the cultural advantages of being childless or to be an urban dweller or not to have a yard or not to get married till you're 35 or to live with a woman and not marry her. Not that that doesn't permeate America, but in every aspect of our lives, and I mentioned things like sports and the media, there's two different avenues there. And the country's bifurcating geographically, it's bifurcating culturally, politically, economically, and socially.
The next factor that you cite, I think, is closely related to that one, and it's what you call in the piece clustering. And this has to do with mobility and a kind of geographic self-selection. Tell us about the dynamic that's at work there.
Well, you know, when I was growing up, I didn't know anything about Tennessee, and I didn't know Nashville was a great place to move to. Nobody even talked to me that, hey, you should go to – my parents never said, wow, we should go to Austin because it doesn't have a state income tax. And the point I'm making is that now with the internet and instant communication, we can just find any – in the next 2 seconds, I can get a picture of any downtown. I can get tables about cost of living, taxation, quality of schools. That's instantly at my fingertips. And with jet travel being very cheap, it's much easier to tow a trailer today than it was 30 years ago. So people have the mobility and they have the information to make choices. And it tends to be that people who want less government and more traditional life go to states like Idaho or Utah or maybe Texas, and that people who want more government and what they call more culture go to places like the Bay Area or Research Triangle in North Carolina or, you know, Greenwich Village. So the result of it is that blue states get bluer and red states get more red, and I think we look at that map now, and it's a sea of, by congressional district, it's a sea of red geographically that overwhelms the country. But when we readjust for population, it's two balloons come out from each coast and they bury the red. So it's split between a dominant geography and a dominant population.
You also point to open borders as another source of division. And it's no secret, of course, that immigration is one of the big fault lines in American life. But you make an interesting point about the arc of this, which is that, again, if you go back about a decade, the divide between the two parties on this wasn't all that large, certainly not compared to today. So explain what that world looked like and what's changed in the interim.
Yeah, even 10 years ago, people like Joe Biden and Hillary and Bill Clinton and even Barack Obama as a senator were giving us lectures that illegal immigration was wrong, you had to enforce the borders, the melting pot was good. And I think that was just based on the idea in those days that the Democratic Progressive Party wanted to protect their union workers and their poor, and they thought that rampant immigration, especially from the third world, would overtax social services or welfare. The locus classicus of that example would be Cesar Chavez going down in the early 60s to the border with union UFW members and physically beating illegal aliens to keep out because you'll drive down wages. That's transmogrified because of the sheer number of illegal immigrants from, you know, maybe a resident population of 2 or 3 million up to as high as the Yale study suggests, 20 million. And with the Anchor-Bagby policy, we've got now two generations of kids growing up that are voting. And the Democratic Party took a look at California that will never be red again, and that Nevada will probably be never red again, and New Mexico will never be red again, probably Colorado, maybe Arizona, maybe even Texas. And they said, you know what, this idea of rampant immigration, I mean rampant in the sense of not diverse, not meritocratic, not legal, and not measured, actually gives us political advantage, because what we're not winning at the ballot box on ideas, because the progressive message just only appeals to about 26-27% of the American population, we can change the electorate. To change the electorate, we need open borders, and we have to have people coming like this caravan in mass, poor, who rely on entitlements and collective identity politics leadership.
And related, the fourth factor that you cite in this piece is what you call the salad bowl, which is the growing tendency to identify primarily by race or ethnicity rather than to find a common identity as Americans. And the observation I find striking in this piece, Victor, we've talked about this on the show before, but not particularly this aspect of it, is you're sort of suggesting in the National Review column that we kind of snatched defeat from the jaws of victory here, that we were actually on a pretty good trajectory on this front, and then it all went south. So describe the trajectory that we were on and how you see the problems presenting themselves now.
Yeah, I think the Mexican-American immigrant experience was analogous to the early 20th century Italian, Sicilian experience, where people came very poor. They were Catholic. They didn't have a lot of professional skills, and they experienced prejudice from a largely Protestant Northern European host population. But then, given that brutal bargain of the melting pot and the fact that those influxes were broken up and people scattered, within three generations, your last name, Italian name, whatever it was, if it was, you know, Roma, or I've mentioned this before, Giuliani or Scalise or Cuomo or Pelosi, nobody could predict how you're going to vote today. But that's not yet true with, if I say Gonzalez in California or Lopez Martinez, we assume that that person is going to vote liberal and Democratic for the most part. And the statistics show that's true in 70% of the cases. So that didn't have to happen. I think in the early 60s and 70s, we were starting to see manageable groups of people coming from Mexico. The host believed in the melting pot. They tried to rapidly assimilate people. The intermarriage was very high, and it became incidental to be Mexican-American, not essential. And then suddenly, to be more graphic, when I was in grammar school, if your name was Juan Lopez and you were 100% Mexican-American, you just arrived, you usually were called Johnny Lopez. You wanted to be Johnny to assimilate. Now, if you're one quarter Mexican-American, I can test, I'm speaking from fact, not just speculation. You're one quarter Mexican-American, and your name is John Lopez, and you don't speak Spanish at all, you have no accent, you're going to be Juan Lopez, because then assimilating bought or earned perceived advantages. And today, not assimilating, but identifying tribally is assumed to offer distinct advantages. And that's the difference. And one is a superior model, the assimilations, than to the tribal model.
The last source of division that you cite in the piece is the post-war order. That is the role that America constructed for itself in the wake of the Cold War's end. And again, this is a story where there was a time when the trajectory of this was regarded as almost miraculous, that we were going to have peace and prosperity, that we were moving into a unipolar world that was characterized by American dominance, and that these were going to be our salad days. But you look at this and see some of the seeds of our current discontent embedded in that project. Describe that for us.
Yeah, I think during the Cold War, we didn't have a margin of error. So from 1946 to, say, 1989, it was assumed in Europe that the United States was indispensable, that its military had saved them from Soviet communism in the way it had from German militarism in the past, that you were very skeptical of the UN, you were very proud of NATO. The United States was willing to take hits, so to speak, on trade and reciprocal commerce, because we were trying to empower emerging economies. We still believe that if an authoritarian country was given trade surpluses and brought into the family of nations, we could liberalize it. And then all, and that was pretty much considered to be a success, a fait accompli by 1989. We had all that great, remember all that great news, the Berlin Wall fell in 89, 90, 91, the Soviet Union disappeared. We had the unification of Germany in 1990. George Bush gave that speech about a new world order on September 11th of all dates in 1990. We got rid of Saddam with a huge coalition. Francis Fukuyama published The End of History. It was a euphoric idea that the EU was born in 1993. And we got rid of Milosevic. Everybody said, you know what? We're over that bipolar world. We're over that idea of military power. Now the world is going to be ecumenical. There's going to be international organizations, NGOs, soft power. The European model with no borders is superior. And then, of course, that was all contrary to human nature in the course of history. Human nature being what it is, that the strong dictate to the weak and the weak suffer as they must unless you do something to help them. And so suddenly we had, of course, September 11, 2001. We had the meltdown in 2008, and then we had the rise of radical Islam, and then we had unapologetic anger from the Europeans toward the Americans, and then the EU itself was trisected between Brexit and the Eastern Europeans mad about immigration, and then Southern Europeans mad about the financial dictates from Germany. And then we had this German problem again, where Germany seemed to be unified, it was strong, and it was sort of throwing its weight around Europe and even to the United States. And then we've discovered, wow, China's running up a $400 billion surplus, and it hasn't turned into Palm Beach. And we thought it would if we just, you know, said, don't worry about the patents, don't worry about the copyrights, don't worry about the infringement on other agreements, don't worry about technological appropriation, don't worry about dumping. It'll all make them, you know, once they have high-speed rail and they have sparkling new airports, they're going to be sparkling new Democrats. And that just didn't happen. And so out of that disappointment, I think we're at a point now where people are saying, you know, world and history and human experience is tragic. You never get to the end of history. And we better go back to the basics, and that is, a country is defined by its borders. A country is defined by its patriotism. A country is defined by its allies. A country is defined by its enemies. And a country is defined by its national interest. And we're not really interested in wondering whether China is going to become democratic in 2050, because the way it's going, there won't be a Detroit or a Cleveland or, you know, an Indianapolis. They won't exist anymore, given the asymmetrical nature of commerce. So we're back in, I think we're back in history now, and this is very, 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 very angry. There's a lot of anger in Europe about it, because their utopian dreams have been shattered, and Trump did not create this. He walked in and looked at the world as it was rather than it was supposed to be, and being sometimes uncouth, he just said, I don't know where you people have been, but I'm a nationalist. I'm not ashamed of it, and I don't, basically he was saying to the world, I don't care about the International Criminal Court. I do not care what the Council on Foreign Relations tells me. I don't believe the World Bank is sober and judicious. Now NATO, if it's going to exist, has to change its mission and has to be fair. NAFTA, it's not sacrosanct. It took an outsider to tell everybody that the emperor was naked.
So I'll close this conversation in the same way that you closed this piece. It's obviously hard to propose remedies for cultural divisions. You can't pass a piece of legislation and make people change their minds. But your recommendation in the conclusion of this piece is to follow that famous prescription from Hippocrates, which is first do no harm. Operationalize that for us. What does that actually mean in day-to-day life?
I think it means that when you have people who are across this divide, there's no reason to prompt a duel between them. I have two brothers that are Bernie Sanders supporters. So when I see them, I don't try to bait them. They don't try to bait me. We just don't talk about politics. and we try to find a greater degree of commonality. Or when I write a column and I'm like that column or something, I'm not afraid to quote people I don't like and make fun of them. But if it's unnecessary, and I think usually it is, to say this person's an idiot and he said this, or if I have to do an interview or get in TV or whatever it is, I don't try to scream and yell at the person. And so I think it's really important when I give us a lecture, if I have I gave a lecture the other day and there was somebody from Germany, I had been critical of Germany and he went on a rampage. It's much better to say, what is your question? Let's deal with it. Let me answer systematically rather than say, you know, just shut up and sit down. And I think collectively, if we have an ethos that we have sort of a Hippocratic oath, you know, you don't shout down speakers or you don't report news that you can't substantiate by anonymous sources or unnamed sources, or you don't go to people's homes to harass them, or you don't stalk them at work. You can live with these fault lines as long as you don't do the extra thing that's happened in 1861, the extra thing being getting in people's face and caning somebody in the Senate, the House, I mean, or in 1968, blowing people up in Davy terrorist attacks. So we want to stop and let people take a breath. But the way it's getting with Antifa and Black Lives Matter, or Occupy Wall Street, or what we saw at the Kavanaugh hearings, if that is taken to the next step, then they'll be retaliated in kind and then retaliated in kind. And you get something like the Corsairian stasis in Thucydides, where the whole society unwinds. We don't want that, and the only way we can prevent it, I think, is on a personal level, not contributing to it, if you can help it. And sometimes it's difficult. I get a lot of hate mail. I'll be walking, and somebody will have read and thinks he knows who I am, and he'll run up and get in my face and say, how dare you? But you don't want to scream back at him, is what I'm saying. We want to be firm. You don't want to be a pushover, but each, according to our station, I think, can do a lot.
All right. You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read Victor's work at Defining Ideas at hoover.org, as well as at victorhanson.com. And if you enjoy the Classicist, please rate the show on iTunes. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.